Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's bonus episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Layla Latif.
I'm Hannah Strong.
And I'm Marshall Schaefer.
On the show this week, we're reporting live from the Venice Film Festival, where we've been watching some of the most highly anticipated films of the year. All coming up in Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So we're recording live from the Venice Film Festival. If you can hear the sound of crashing waves and Aperol spritzes being down, then that's because we're recording from a beautiful beach on the Lido. We hope not to be too unbearably smug as we give you a run through of some of the most exciting titles from the first half of the festival. Marshall, Hannah and I have been enjoying eating, sleeping and watching films with you this year. But for those of our listeners who don't know who you are, who are you?
Well, hello, Truth and Moviesers. I'm a New York-based freelance journalist. I'm here covering for The Playlist, Slash Film, Decider, and Slant Magazine. I think I'm writing a total of 19 reviews over the course of the festival, so very little downtime between watching and writing, but still enjoying plenty of great chats in our flat and seeing the sights around Venice.
Yeah, I would say anybody looking at us from the outside, this does not look like hard work as we hold up microphones on a beautiful sandy beach.
Indeed.
But Hannah, this is your first time at the festival, seasoned critic, but first time to the Lido. What was it about this year that made you decide to come to Venice?
I'd already bagsied it within the office, like rota for the film festival. I've always wanted to come to Venice, but because of coming to Cannes and Toronto normally, it's just, you know, it's a bit of an ask really to do that many festivals in a year. So I decided this year, I knew I wasn't going to be going to Toronto. So I asked, you know, can I go and do Venice at last? And I was just very fortunate that it's turned out to be quite a stacked lineup this year. I think that Cannes was maybe a little bit lower key than people were anticipating. Things like Blonde didn't end up there. And of course, Netflix is still having their ongoing beef with Thierry. So there's quite a lot of Netflix films here that couldn't go to Cannes, basically. So, yeah, I was just quite fortunate. And I've been very taken aback by how laid out how Venice is laid out compared to Cannes, and how it feels much more chill and you have a lot more time to write between embargoes lifting, so you're not kind of scrambling to be the first person with a tweet. It's a very nice festival atmosphere. We've been very fortunate with the weather so far, and yeah, I'm a big fan already.
Well, I hope to find you back here in about a year's time. But it is just kind of very indulgent and gorgeous, Venice. It's got an incredible old school glamour. It's actually the oldest film festival. Thanks, Mussolini. It's like somewhat thrown off its kind of fascist origins to become something I think really wonderful.
Yeah, but I mean, to the point of indulgence, I was thinking back. So the three of us took a tour of the Ducal Palace on Tuesday before the festival started. And our guide had a really interesting point about how Venice in particular built their entrances to the palace. You know, most Italian entrances are just directly on the waterfront, but Venice, with their grandeur of this giant palatial building, they put the entrance much, much further in to make you appreciate, one, how much space they have and how much how much space there is to just roam around. And just taking in the space, the grandeur, the design, I think that really comes through and trickles down even to the festival today, where, like Hannah was saying, we have so much more time to develop the thoughts around the movies. We're not just rushing into the instant reactions or filing the the quick review. Oftentimes, we're getting to sleep on a film before getting to write the review, which is very, very nice and not a pleasure you get at most other festivals.
And having conversations about films as well. Like, I find that sometimes at film festivals, I kind of don't really want to spend too much time talking to other critics, so I feel like it's going to influence my opinion too much. But actually, like, some of the conversations I've been having after films with my lovely housemates and with other critics have actually really helped me kind of digest films and work out some of the kinks. And I think that's like a really nice thing to be able to do. You're not kind of forced to go and squirrel yourself away in a press lounge like straight away. You've got time to kind of rehydrate and have a sandwich if like me you get like quite low blood pressure, and you know, it's nice to be able to reflect like that.
And by hydrate, Hannah does mean with Aperol Spritz, not with water.
Yes. No, most of our blood types are Aperol Spritz at this point. But yeah, now that you guys have had a little opportunity to digest some of the things that we've seen, I'm excited to talk to you about some of the highlights. Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. You'll receive exclusive perks.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
And an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to the Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of our plans. Now on to the movies. So, I suppose it only makes sense that we start at the very beginning. The opening night film, White Noise, The Return of Noah Baumbach, his third film with Netflix. Hannah, do you want to start? What did you think of White Noise?
Yeah, this was definitely one of my most highly anticipated films of the festival. I'm a huge Adam Driver fan, and of course, Greta Gerwig's long-awaited return to acting as well. Mm-hmm. So, I've got quite a history with Don DeLillo as well. He's a novelist I've kind of loved since my precocious university student days, so I was very, very excited for this, although I kind of was hesitant as well, because I think that maybe Don DeLillo and Noah Baumbach isn't really a connection I would make. I think that Baumbach's realism kind of jars a little bit with this very stylized almost like a train of thought thing that DeLillo has going on in his books. There's a lot of like internal monologues, and that's something that I think is quite hard to translate sometimes. But I was really, you know, excited to watch it, and very much enjoyed his take on this. I think it's him working with a lot more money than we've ever seen before. It's an expensive looking film, but it's weirdly, I mean, anyone that knows the novel White Noise knows it's kind of about the fear of death and mortality. And I was actually surprised at how life-affirming this film felt to me. It's, you know, it's really about finding the one you love and kind of wanting to spend life and death together. And Noah is really good at casting, and I think, you know, obviously Adam and Greta have worked talking about this with their old friends. Adam and Greta have worked together before, and they have such a great kind of rapport together on screen. They're very believable as a couple, and I just loved watching them. And I have to like shout out Don Cheadle as well, because like he's a supporting player here, and he opens the film giving this incredible speech about car crashes in American culture, with this like footage of car crashes in film, and immediately I was getting like big Crash vibes from that. I really enjoyed his supporting turn. I was very entertained, and yeah, I mean, because I wrote my review, I'm kind of just like, what can I say that I didn't say in my review, you know? I will hand over to Marshall to say more about it.
Yeah, Marshall, I think this is really a film that lends itself to like so much discussion, so much analysis, so much kind of picking apart. Was it a great start to you for the festival?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, to Hannah's point about just the denseness of Don DeLillo, I had read the book probably about 10 years ago. I actually revisited some of my notes from my high school English class when I was writing my review, which was very helpful. Shout out Mr. Lambert. But I think it was... Well, so many people have commented that this novel is unfilmable for years because of just how thick the prose of DeLillo is, and just some of these just really extensive paragraphs of nonsensical is the wrong word for it, but just kind of rambling postmodern observations about this kind of consumerist hellscape. And I think Baumbach approached the challenge of that by ultimately just not really even trying to translate those things. I think it's a fool's errand. And frankly, I think that's where Cronenberg got a little bit tripped up in Cosmopolis. He really just kind of focuses in on the part of the novel to which he can relate, which is overeducated elites who are kind of missing the point in their aloofness about how vulnerable they are to the way of the world. I mean, also to Hannah's point, I was also taken by how sweet and sincere it was. I think you get a little bit of some of the Noah Baumbach barbed dialogue that really made his name in films like Kicking and Screaming and Mr. Jealousy. Mm-hmm. But you get a lot of the sweetness that, frankly, I think you can attribute to his artistic partnership with Greta Gerwig. I think you really start to see a turn in his movies around Frances Ha whenever they started collaborating much more closely. And Layla, I love what you had to say about the film and really interpreting it through the lens of marriage. And I don't think they're formally partnered in that way, but I think you can definitely read a lot into it about the partnership that they share on and off screen and what that means and how the contradictions of marriage do not nullify it, but you can find meaning from within them.
Yeah, no, I do worry that I'm going to horrify a lot of people and my husband in telling them that I've never seen my own marriage so well represented. Oh. But Marsha, I want to move on to a film that I know that you really loved at the festival, and that is Athena.
Heck yes. Yeah, I was not even planning to see this until I got assigned to review it, because it comes out on Netflix so soon. So keep an eye out, I was thinking about how to phrase it. It's most likely the kind of film that Netflix will not advertise directly at the top of your screen, so you might have to go search for it, but I promise it is worth the look. This is a film by French filmmaker Romain Gavras, who's made two kind of angry young men films called Our Day Will Come and The World Is Yours. This is a bit of a zag for him. He's working with Laj Lee, the Academy Award nominated filmmaker of Les Miserables, another sort of social unrest in the Paris banlieue story. And this is just an unbelievably accomplished feat of technical filmmaking. It's very much of the school of thought to where if you can do any scene in one take, you should. It opens with one of the most jaw-dropping Wonners, that runs over 10 minutes long as the unrest in a small French community starts to spill over from the civilians to the cops. They sack the station, steal a bunch of stuff, and then take the cars back to the neighborhood. And only a few minutes in, we start to kind of realize, oh, wow, there really hasn't been a cut. How long is he going to keep this going? Mm-hmm. And the acrobatics of it are just phenomenal. It shows things and does motions with the camera that you forgot are possible. It's really just something, and I don't think it's just a pure technical feat. It's also very interesting in the way in which it's grappling with the themes of police brutality and relationships between authority and civilians, as represented by the three brothers of a young man who was killed by someone on video that the police will not identify. And each of them have a very different way of responding to the event. And just this all-out urban warfare really reveals their character. The film doesn't feel the need to just kind of stop and explain it or give them a lot of expository dialogue that would kind of clue you into who they are. It's really just kind of battle-worn wisdom. And it has truly one of the most explosive final scenes that I can really remember. I left having to pick my jaw up off the floor and cannot recommend this film enough. It's been the highlight of the festival for me. Even better because I wasn't even planning to see it.
But, you know, speaking of riots, as somebody that got here on the 6:45 Vaporetto a couple of days ago, I found myself surrounded by teenage girls, not quite sure what was going on. And then they stampeded towards the red carpet to wait for 14 hours for Timothy Chalamet to show up for Bones and All. Hannah, obviously, they were just here to have a little glimpse at the guy. You actually got to see the film. What do you think of Chalamet? Are you now, you know, are you going to be joining the crowds next year to kind of get a glimpse of him in a red halter neck?
Oh, God, I'm too old for any of that. But I was always I mean, I like him well enough in Call Me By Your Name, but he's yet to kind of like really, really impress me. So I was interested in this. I love Luca Guadagnino more widely. I wasn't a Suspiria fan.
I don't think even he's a Suspiria fan.
I think he maybe admit that he made a few missteps there. I don't know, or maybe he wouldn't. I know he wants to make a sequel, so he already thinks he's got unfinished business, but no, so I was, you know, I never count a director out after one, so I was intrigued to see how he translated this love story between two teenage cannibals with Timothy and Taylor Russell, excuse me, who is an upcoming actress, Canadian actress, I believe, and she is very good in a quite small role in Trey Schultz's Waves, which I really like, but I know a lot of people have issues with.
I also liked it. This is a safe space.
Yeah. So, yeah, I really like the novel that it's based on, which is also called Bones and All. The way I pronounce it in my accent, Bones and All, is doing it a disservice. But I was really kind of, you know, I was going in wanting to like it, but ready to dislike it, if that makes sense, and was amazed, very much to my surprise. I loved it, and I think it's probably my film of the festival so far. I just really thought it was romantic and earnest and surprisingly gory, and it really just kind of, Chalamet's performance and Russell's performance, I think, are just so well attuned to each other, and they really understand these characters, and it feels like a world that is lived in. And just Luca's like kind of eye for detail and eye for production design, it's just a really gorgeous looking film, and I love the contrast between the kind of visceral disgust of flesh eating and the kind of this very, very tender romance between these outsiders who feel like they are the only two people like them in the world. And it's, you know, I can't hate anything that's kind of got a bit of Badlands energy to it. So, you know, yeah, I was a big fan of this one.
Yeah, I feel I can give this film no higher compliment that just after it ended, I found Marshall and then I jotted down in the back of my diary, I added it to my top 10 of the year list immediately, and you can see the kind of tear stains like blurring the ink on that page. But Hannah, one of the biggest surprises of the festival is that you weren't that big a fan of The Master Gardener. People will have seen your review online. Marshall, were you impressed by the new Schrader?
Yeah, and I should also note that I also encountered the Timothée Chalamet stands. They're flocking to the Lido for the public screening of Bones and All yesterday morning, caused me to miss my Master Gardener screening and rearrange my schedule to fit it in this morning, and I'm certainly glad that I did. I was not the biggest fan of the card counter. I know, much to the dismay of many people, although I've kept that disdain a little bit more quiet, and I really thought this was an excellent rebound for him. At this point, you kind of know what you're getting with a late Paul Schrader film, the man alone in the room with his thoughts, the most dangerous thing in the world, et cetera, et cetera. But I think what makes this one a real cut above for me, and when I say cut above, that's only the card counter. I think First Reformed will remain his masterpiece.
Again, boo.
What?
I love First Reformed. I just can't be here for all of this card counter naysaying. Sorry, Marshall. Please continue.
But yeah, I think what sets this one apart for me is that it's a slightly different look at the Paul Schrader character journey, where I think the sort of rebirth that so often punctuates his films at the end is really the beginning of Master Gardener. You have the Joel Edgerton character, who is formerly a neo-Nazi and basically becomes an informant who disrupts the group and then starts a new life as a gardener for a wealthy family. And it really, it posits the idea that a sort of spiritual rebirth is not a switch that you flip so much as it is a recurring process. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he's having to kind of go through these things again and again becomes a form of, you know, eternally recurrent torture and punishment for him. I think the ways in which Edgerton has to really prostrate himself before other people is very profound. And I will not compare this against anything else that might earn me another boo, but I think Joel Edgerton is a very good Schrader anti-hero. I think he has a very laconic look about him and feel that really communicates the sadness and the loneliness of his character. I think if it can be played as too cool, it can be a bit alluring. Mm-hmm. And I think here, especially given the fact that he is a former neo-Nazi who has not taken the time to remove all the tattoos, including one that says "White Power" on it.
Oh yeah, no, they're not. There's not a lot of subtext.
No, one does not usually come to Schrader for subtext.
No, I mean, but even whoever that tattoo artist was, they really just were just like, no, let's speak this plainly upon your flesh.
I thought Edgerton gave a masterful performance as the titular Master Gardener.
Yeah, I mean, anyone that listens to this podcast regularly knows how hard I ride for Edgerton. But even if Hannah is going to be slightly of a bit of a naysayer, I think that, like, it's going to at very least kind of prove that Edgerton has been brilliant all along. And I'm glad that the culture...
I do think that he's good in that film.
I will fight
He's good
you.
In my Master Gardener. I would struggle to name five other films he's in.
Oh my goodness. I mean, this is such erasure of the Exodus Gods and Kingdom where he had to be cast.
Oh, if you're pulling out...
I'm just saying you can't name a film. Ridley Scott said that he couldn't cast Mohammed so-and-so because he needed the star power of Joel Edgerton.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, since then, Loving, Underground Railroad, fabulous, and It Comes at Night. Like, I'm very glad for the rest of the culture to catch up with me when it comes to Joel Edgerton. But let's talk about a smaller title now. Hannah, you saw Other People's Children, is that right?
So this was Other People's Children by Rebecca Zoltowski, who is a filmmaker I don't have a lot of familiarity with. She made a film called An Easy Girl, which I think a lot of my friends kind of mentioned to me, and I just never watched
it. Yeah, no, An Easy Girl is great.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah, there we go. You guys know more than I do. But no, I went into this because I love Virginia Effery, and I will kind of watch her do anything. And I liked the premise. So it's a film about a teacher who enters a new relationship and forms a very close bond with her new boyfriend's young daughter, Layla, who is 4, and she is very cute. And so I was, kind of interested to see it and was very taken with this film. I think it's a really deft exploration of that relationship between parental figures who are, you know, not the parent, but are close enough to a child to kind of love them and care for them and, you know, take them to their Judo lessons and still feel that acute distance that is inevitably there. And, you know, the way that Rachel has to kind of move her whole life around for this relationship and this small child is really significant. But it's something she does, like, quite willingly. You know, there's never any resentment involved, but it's such a difficult kind of situation to enter. And then, you know, she's kind of questioning her own desire for children and kind of if she's going to be able to start a family. And I just thought it was a really kind of fertile ground for exploration that I don't think we often really get to see in cinema unless it's portrayed in kind of a like a parent trap evil stepmother kind of way. So yeah, I was very impressed. And if you love cute children, being cute, then you're gonna have a great time with this one, because the little girl who plays Layla is adorable. She's so cute.
Lots of adorable Laylas out there. just saying. So one of the big things that coming into the festival, Marshall, was like that we were going to be here at the official start of the Brendanaissance. Brendan Fraser is back after, you know, he was not treated well. Some terrible things happened to him that we don't need to go.
Well, it's not like he went away. He just really did not occupy the same place in the culture that he did at the kind of the tail end of the 90s and the early 2000s, that kind of the peak of his mummy heyday.
Mm-hmm. But so he's back with Aronofsky, someone who I think has kind of very mixed will, coming into it. I fucking hated Mother. Some opinions may vary. But I think even if people didn't necessarily get that excited for the new Aronofsky, would you agree that everybody was super excited for the new Brendan Fraser?
Yes, I would definitely say that I think he was the real highlight and not necessarily Aronofsky. Though certainly, he's opened the Venice Film Festival before, I believe, with Black Swan, is a regular here at the festival, and it's a very visceral filmmaker who's made a lot of movies that have made a lot of people get into movies. I think a new one of his films is always certainly an event.
Mm-hmm. Hannah, like, you were pretty kind of nervous coming into The Whale. I was quite surprised that when I kind of grabbed you on the water bus back to St. Mark's Square, that you seemed to be someone that was going to defend this, which a film which I think inevitably is going to spark a discourse.
Yeah, I was probably one of the people who was really, really dreading this film as someone who has quite a complicated relationship with eating and eating disorders and has been kind of overweight / fat pretty much since I was like a small child. I was very, very worried about this and kind of dreading the discourse it will inevitably spark, and just thinking about like the way people react to fat characters and how the majority of fat characters in films are treated as a joke or something to be kind of, disparaged or, you know, pathetic. And I think there is a little bit of that in The Whale. There's some elements of it that I really found quite uncomfortable, which I think is you're meant to. But, I just think it's a sensitive subject and not one that many people either have the capacity to talk about or have the capacity to talk about well. So I was a little bit worried. But Brendan Fraser has been very open about his own kind of struggle with his weight and kind of how he does look very, very different now to how he did 20, nearly 30 years ago when he was kind of this gorgeous young thing who, you know, George the Jungle.
Yeah, he's still gorgeous. How dare you? He arrived on the Lido today wearing a fabulous straw hat and a gorgeous suit. Silwood.
I would just like to indicate that that was not me besmirching Brendan's current appearance. It's just that he looks different to how he did then. And, you know, time will do that to a man. But he also, you know, kind of had to grapple with being sexually assaulted and then being kind of shunned by Hollywood. So the guy has had a lot of kind of, you know, he's been through it. He's had his hardships. And so I was excited for him to kind of get a good role he could really sink his teeth into, because it does feel like I've really wanted someone to kind of take that chance on him. And I think Aronofsky, although I'm not the biggest fan of his, he does give actors roles that they really can challenge themselves with. I mean, Jennifer Lawrence talked a lot about it with Mother. Mother's not a film that I like either. I'm very, very, very much not a fan of that film. But I think he challenges actors, and that is usually a good thing in my book. But yeah, no, I was surprised by this film. I actually think it does the topic justice. I think it's surprisingly empathetic for a Darren Aronofsky film. I don't think he's a particularly sensitive filmmaker. And Brendan is great. I think he has this real kind of like optimism about him, I think, as a person off screen, and then I think that kind of translates into something on screen. There's this like this vulnerability that I think really works for this character. And although I think the script kind of wants you to find him a bit pathetic, or, you know, kind of, well, I mean, it's called The Whale. I think it wants you to kind of find him a little bit monstrous. I think the fact it has this, you know, real kind of powerhouse actor who's kind of, you know, we have the context of what Brendan Fraser has kind of been through. I think that really kind of means that he's able to harness all of that into this like performance that I think is really strong.
I mean, not to make this an entirely giant Brendan Fraser love fest, but Marshall, like, I mean, Aronofsky previously, I suppose the comparison is what he did with Mickey Rourke in The Wrestler, which is to a degree was not sustained for very long in terms of renaissances. Do you have higher hopes for the Brendanaissance?
I mean, I would hope so. I will say, not to kind of throw some cold water on this, I think Brendan Fraser does give a very good performance in the film, but I think he's somewhat held back by just how much Aronofsky wants you to kind of meet him more than in the middle by supplying your own fond feelings of Brendan Fraser to the character. I think the character that Mickey Rourke plays, Randy the Ram, in The Wrestler is a little bit more fully fleshed out, has a little bit more of a chance to explain himself, to detail his feelings, to show both kind of him at his glory and him at his at the pit in which we find him, where I think The Whale is more or less just kind of like the pit, and really very, very little else. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I think it does limit the extent to which Fraser can really flex his acting chops.
Yeah, I just kind of, it's very difficult when you have such goodwill towards an actor that, like, I want him to get every golden statuette, but almost like I didn't even need to see the film in order to, like, have this feeling
right,
of rooting for that guy so
that's
hard.
That's kind of what I feel to some extent, is, like, it is so dependent on you trading on positive will that somewhere in that void between person and persona, I just kind of felt the ways in which I was being manipulated and started to resist it a little bit.
Oh, fair enough. Hannah, let's finish up with another smaller title that you saw. What was Blue Jean all about?
Yeah, Blue Jean is this film by Georgia Oakley, who is a British filmmaker who has done a few shorts before, and this is her feature debut, and it's set during the kind of zenith of Maggie Thatcher's Britain. Yeah, exactly. And it's about this PE teacher called Jean, who is played by Rosie McEwen, and she is a closeted lesbian who has quite a difficult relationship, not only with her sexuality, but with her family, who do not know that she's gay. And it's really just a kind of quiet, quite intimate film about a woman who is caught between wanting to be herself and wanting to kind of do this job that she really loves, whilst we have the backdrop of Section 28 coming in, which obviously was about, quote unquote, banning the promotion of homosexuality in schools, and I didn't realise that it was kind of in force until the early 2000s, so it's quite a long time that if you were gay and worked in a school, you were done for, kind of. There was a real hate campaign against gay people, and, you know, portraying them as predators. So there's a little bit of that in this film, in that we have this new student who has started at the school where Jean teaches, and she's getting bullied and called a lesbian, and Jean has to kind of choose whether or not to, you know, kind of put herself on the line or just kind of turn a blind eye to it. And it's, you really feel for her. It's a very kind of complicated situation, and I just like that the film feels very sympathetic to her situation without kind of, you know, fully agreeing with the decisions she makes and the kind of things she says and things she does. And it's a really, yeah, a very impressive debut from Georgia Oakley. It looks gorgeous. It's really, you get all these different shades of blue, as the title would suggest, and it just, you get that kind of sense of the isolation and the kind of the idea of hiding yourself and hiding parts of yourself away. And I was just, yeah, I was very impressed. I don't want to hype it too much because I feel like sometimes with British filmmakers we can really like set them up for a fall by, you know, just totally overhyping their films, and then you know, kind of they come out and people don't really like them as much as the festival crowd.
Yeah, that does feel like a bit of a kind of slight dig at After Sun, but
I can possibly say. But yeah, no, it's a very impressive debut, and I think will resonate with a lot of people, and has a really good soundtrack as well. We've got some New Order in there, which, you know, I was very happy about, and yeah, it's just very good, very apt film at the moment, I think, for British culture as well. You know, all the kind of transphobia rise we've got in the UK, I think it's good to be reminded of just how damaging it is, not only for like queer people, but for everyone that surrounds them, when we get to this level of refusing to have conversations about this with kids, and, you know, kind of let them know it's okay to be gay, it's okay to be trans. And, you know, I just found it a really deft handling of a subject that you don't always see explored with that kind of nuance.
Oh, wow. I mean, that's a wonderful note to end things on. Some very exciting films that are coming up. But before we go, I'd just like to ask you, we've got a few more days of the festival left. What are you most looking forward to? Hannah, do you want to start?
Yeah, I think my number one hype title is Blonde by Andrew Dominik. Obviously, the Marilyn Monroe fantasia on Marilyn themes, as I am calling it. It is not a biopic. It is a fiction. And I think the sooner people realise it's not a biopic, the happier they will be, because it is exhausting watching people write about this film before they've even seen it. I just think it's, you know, come on. I love Andrew Dominik. I think his filmmaking is great. Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford is a masterpiece. And yeah, he's always just so, he's good value. Yeah. I think he's Andrew Dominik, both on and off screen. And yeah, Ana de Armas, goddess. Can't wait to see her both on the screen and on the Lido, wearing, I'm sure, what would be gorgeous gowns, great gowns. Yeah. So yeah, that's mine.
Maybe 6:45, you and I are going to be storming off the earliest water bus in order to capture that. But yeah, I agree with you. I have a lot of faith in Andrew Dominik. I've loved all of his films, and I love that he, like Paul Schrader, doesn't give a fuck if you like him or not. But Marshall, what about you? What is your most anticipated that's coming up in the next few days?
I'm weirdly very excited for a title that I think is flying a little bit under the radar, called Dreamin' Wild. It's a film by Bill Pollard, who's normally a producer, but maybe known to some film fans for directing the film Love and Mercy, a sort of anti-biopic about Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, kind of splitting his life and bifurcating it between the very early days in which he's making Pet Sounds, and then a later incarnation in which he's under the tutelage of a very abusive doctor. This time is another musician film. It's about the Everly Brothers. And I really know very little about it, and I'm just very excited and hope that it is something a little bit more innovative in this very tried and often very trite genre.
Walton Goggins.
Yes,
it's got Walter. It's got a great cast. I'm shouting. Yeah. It's got a great cast.
We won't talk about the lead. We'll just talk about Walton Goggins.
Yeah, Walter Goggins, Noah Jupe, and Jack Dylan Grazer. Great cast.
Noah Jupe and Jack Dylan Grazer, who will one day run the industry.
Oh God, I hope so. That is a future that I can really believe in. I'm very excited to see both of those films. I have high hopes for both, and I have got high hopes for the rest of the festival. It's been fucking amazing so far. I mean, it really has been such a stacked lineup, and a very few disappointments from my perspective. So if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, there'll be your regular podcast programming covering Crimes of the Future, Both Sides of the Blade, and Street Trash, as well as another special bonus episode about the second half of the festival. Thanks very much for tuning in, and if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were Hannah Strong and Marshall Schaefer. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Jake Cunningham.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.